Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of The Political Party as part of this replay series where I have handpicked. I don't know why I say handpicked. I mean, I've used my hands to go through my iPod, iPhone, and scroll through the feed. And I guess I typed up all of this with my hands, but not quite the same as going through a stack of vinyl, is it? But I guess I use my hands, so I don't know why I've been so pernickety with myself about the use of the phrase handpicked. But in a way, I think my head picked them. Specifically my brain. Welcome to this brain-picked selection of shows from the back catalogue of the political party while I'm in hospital. So, I'm just finding new ways to say it, but I think I'm just saying the same words and emphasising them differently. This is with Nick Clegg from 2016, and obviously the 2015 election, the year before, had put an end to 5 years of coalition rule and Nick Clegg's leadership of the Lib Dems. And this is a fascinating interview with him about his time as leader of the Lib Dems, about his time as an MEP before that, his life, upbringing, career, but really focusing on this 5 years, unprecedented years, for my generation, seeing a coalition government, for most of us, we'd never seen it, and seeing it function in the way that it did, and seeing it survive way better than people thought it would. Nick Clegg obviously now has gone on to work for Meta and continues to be an influence on a global level. But in 2016, he was just over a year after leaving office, and this is a frank and fascinating interview. Enjoy.
Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've had some... I think every guest we've had here has been fantastic. And it's always interesting to talk to people at different points in their career. There are certain people... that wasn't a joke. there are certain politicians, though, that are at the start of their career, that are a bit cagey, some of the ones that have been through it and are very candid about their past performances. There are certain politicians that I genuinely think are part of the sort of political psychology of the nation, people that you sort of follow vicariously on their journey, people that are intensely popular that we have an emotional relationship with, and then when things falter, the relationship feels more compromised. And I think tonight's guest is certainly one of those people, someone who the country felt deep amounts of affection for, went on a journey with, and I think now actually feels affection for them again, and a deep respect for what they've been through. He's had a phenomenal career. He's a gentleman and a very funny man. Please give a huge reception to Nick Clegg. That was a heck of a reception.
Yeah, I'm going to go now. Can't get any better than that.
Almost as... Yeah, it was like Clegg Mania all over again.
and as short.
I mean, there are so many things we need to talk about, but as we've mentioned Clegg Mania, one thing I always wanted to ask you is, the first time you heard, I think it was Gordon Brown said it rather than David Cameron, I can't remember which one, the first time you heard, I agree with Nick, what was your immediate reaction? Did you think it was a ploy?
I don't think I really noticed it fully. I mean, the weird thing about those leaders' debates are that if you are sort of participating in them, what happens to the participant, or at least what happened to me was, I remember this was, it was in Manchester, or was it Manchester maybe, that first debate. You get led off, I get straight into a car, and I was in a hotel about 45 minutes away somewhere, and I sort of drove off in the car, didn't turn the radio on or anything. I rang my mum. She went, yeah, you did all right. I went, oh, that's nice. And then I got to the hotel, and I got to the hotel much before the rest of my team, who obviously stayed there spinning sort of furiously. And it was only when they came about 2 hours later that they sort of said it had sort of got a kind of very positive reception. So it's kind of, odd. It's you don't really, of course, you don't know how it's going to be refracted or responded to at all. And I didn't at all that evening.
And the decision to look down the barrel of the camera, was that something you'd rehearsed in advance?
I'll tell you this is absolutely true. So the other parties, I think, had sort of squillionaire paid American consultants flown over. Mm. I was given a laptop with a little ear thing to
a headphone.
Headphone. Did you call a headphone? Earphone, actually. To watch, and someone had assembled a disc of clips from the American debates.
Okay.
And I used to listen to that as I sort of was going up and down the train to Sheffield. And I remember seeing, now who was it? It was one of the American, was it Clinton?
Clinton.
And Clinton this headphone or earphone didn't work very well. And I couldn't really hear very much. And it was quite a noisy train and the rest of it. And I remember being sort of quite sort of struck by the fact that, because I could hardly hear what was going on in these debates, the fact that he looked at me in this little laptop made me think, oh, right, I want to hear what he has to say. And that was honestly the origins of, it was no more elaborate or scientific than that. It was just the experience of watching the American debates on a laptop made me realise that someone looking at, I mean, it's hardly rocket science if you think about it, but
no, but it felt like it at the time.
Yes.
You know, it certainly was different because politicians didn't behave like that, and it felt like you sort of invented that style of looking straight down the camera, and it had a genuine effect. So the following day, so you've had the period where you've spoken to your mum,
yes,
and then you sort of feel like you've done well, and your team are telling you you've done well. Waking up in the morning, the following morning, did you feel like, oh, I'm a bit more popular today?
it was a little. I'll tell you what I did. I mean, I have to admit, I did feel a bit sort of. That showed them. No, because you know, because I was like, you know, any other Lib Dem. No one had any idea who I was. It was all the only. If anyone said anything about the Lib Dems in the earliest part of that general election, it was just derision, yeah. Mockery. We're back to that now, aren't we? and so there was a sort of feeling of kind of, you know, sort of punching above our weight, which was great. And then of course, very quickly, the dilemma became. Once you, I mean, it's like sort of taking a little, you know, it's like a sort of boat out to a little sort of sailing dinghy, and then there's no wind, and then suddenly this great gust of wind pushes you forward, and then trying to work out what to do with that was quite difficult, actually, because it then developed a kind of momentum of its own. And then I do remember thinking and saying to people at the time that people were kind of reading into the Lib Dems and into me all sorts of hope. I mean, talk about, you know, a sort of prescient thing to sort of feel. People were sort of reading into us sort of all sorts of hopes that couldn't possibly be met. So I doubled up on that particular, that particular prediction later. But
did you? So that's a very sort of political assessment of it.
Yes.
But as a person as well, you must have thought it actually feels quite nice. Some people are being nice to me in the street.
Yeah, no, of course, it's nice when people are nice to you and want to hear you speak and so on. But there's some sort of interesting sort of. Bits thinking back on it, it was the first time, oddly enough, that I've ever experienced how the mood of a crowd can change in an instant. And it wasn't at the sort of height of tuition fees and all the kind of vilification. It was the height of Clegg mania. I remember
airports, knickers.
It was very, very brief. Well, since you asked me about them, I'll dwell on it for an hour if you like. I remember we went to visit a pub in, I think it was Shropshire or something, and it was quite a hot afternoon. And it's quite clear when our kind of banana-coloured Lib Dem bus came into this kind of paddock that there were lots of people there had been drinking, and they were like surging forward, and it got quite sort of uncontrolled. And then suddenly it turned quite ugly. I mean, just like in an instant, something which was supposed to be, you know, all about kind of positive sort of support. And so the police protection people bundled me back into the banana-coloured bus, and we buggered off again.
And what was it that turned the crowd?
I don't know. I think maybe there's some people, some scuffles as people were trying to get from one place to another.
But it was nothing to do with anything you'd said.
No, I hadn't spoken yet. but again, boy, is that a contrast with subsequent elections I've been in, which were all, you know, I mean, so elections these days, at least amongst the sort of big parties, I guess, are all the events are so carefully scripted and planned and orchestrated and all the rest of it. And in that immediate period after that first leaders' debates, you know, the Lib Dems, we didn't know how to cope with this. And suddenly thousands of people would come to events which had been organised for 25 local activists. You know, get sort of swamped by all these people. So it was a very uncontrolled thing, which was very exciting.
So the leaders' debates, in terms of the politics then of arriving at them and then being backstage, were you, Cameron and Brown, kept apart? Or then you sort of stood by the stage together and there was a bit of small talk?
So you get given your own kind of room to kind of prepare in, and they give you makeup and put the mics on and all the rest of it. But then, it's like a sort of, you know, just by a boxing ring, you're brought out to I mean, you might as well go like that and have a sort of towel around your shoulders. Yeah. Exactly the same atmosphere. And I remember after the first leaders' debate, of course, all the right-wing press, they went, oh, shit, these Lib Dems, these pesky Lib Dems we've ignored or mocked for years, they might actually steal some Tory votes. So they absolutely went for me. And there was, you know, banner headline stuff in the Daily Telegraph, sort of alleging corruption, and the Daily Mail saying that the Daily Mail said Clegg's Nazi slur on Britain. I mean, all this bonkers stuff. And of course, that consumed a lot of the time of my team, sort of trying to answer to all this. Absolutely, sort of an incoming flack. And I remember in the second leaders' debates, when we were just waiting by the door before going onto the stage, so David Cameron turned to me and said, "You've had quite a day of it, haven't you?" Sly little, yeah.
But was there, do you think he tried to sort of cultivate a friendship between you two to sort of leave out Brown in those debates? Was there a sense that he sort of cozied up and said he's different, we're similar?
Oh, no, I think Cameron was absolutely convinced he was going to walk it and win the election sort of, you know, outright himself. So I don't think there was any... I don't think there was any ulterior.
Okay.
But I mean, he was certainly better at the chit-chat than Gordon was.
So what was Gordon? What was Gordon like?
Well, he's like a great sort of bear of a figure, isn't he? Yeah.
And he shits in the woods?
No.
But was there any warmth there?
Is he one
not particularly.
You know, well done,
No, but it wasn't like that. To be fair, it wasn't like that. I'll tell you, the weirder occasion was in the... sort of multiple leaders debate in this last one last year.
Yes.
You know, the one with seven or eight of us suddenly.
Yeah.
And there was a break. And then we suddenly ended up all of the urinals together. So it's
what? What, Nicola Sturgeon and Natalie Bennett?
No.
Yeah. Bloody hell.
Yes. I know, extraordinary, isn't it? I said the wrong loo.
So you, Cameron Miliband,
yeah,
Farage?
No, he wasn't there, was he? No, he wasn't there. Was he there? He wasn't at the urinals at all. I would have remembered that.
And was there any chat at the urinal?
It was a bit, but it's so sort of British. So you're on the stage in front of the whole nation, tearing strips off each other, and then you're sort of in the urinals going, cold out, you know.
That's your excuse. Yeah. We sort of
make them. I should rephrase that completely.
Were you sort of tempted to peek and just think?
No.
So I'd be slightly.
Anyway, let's move on now.
So Cameron was more sort of warm, and then there was that incredible period where before the negotiations started. The ball was in the Tories' court. I remember watching it on TV with that beautiful backdrop Cameron used to use somewhere not far from here.
Oh,
actually.
The windows, isn't
the
it?
Window with the garden behind it. I want to make a big and genuine foot of the Liberal Democrats. You must have been watching that live on TV. At that point, did you think that's someone we can do business with? Was it immediately obvious that was going to happen, or was there still a way to go at that point?
So I took. We all in sort of the Lib Dem camp. We took very seriously this idea that. And it wasn't just a sort of soundbite, it was a kind of, and I think it was, I actually think it proved its worth over time, that if you were going to create a coalition and if the Lib Dems were going to be in it, it had to be on the strongest possible kind of basis of legitimacy. Mm. And so that, you know, for us, and I kept saying this, I was saying this for months in the run-up to the election, kept saying over and over again, the party with the most votes and the most seats clearly has, even if they haven't got a majority, have got the right to try and assemble a government. And I remember the first time I said that was, I think, on the Andrew Marr show about 6 months or so before the election. I do remember Cameron was waiting in the green room and he was going to go on to the Marr show later. Yeah. And then I remember him popping his head in, and he heard that, and he said, "That's the first time you've said that, haven't you?" And so they clearly had been thinking.
Smart.
Yeah, it was quite great. They had been thinking about, you know, what if we don't and the rest of it. And with hindsight now, you know, it's all revealed that, I think it's been revealed since then, that the Tories had kind of done the numbers and realised it was a bigger mountain to climb, perhaps, than, you know, to get an outright majority of their own. Anyway, so I'd said that over and over and over and over again, and said it in the debates, and said it in every single interview. And so it was very kind of, the ball was very firmly in his court to see whether he'd sort of respond to that. You know, he had the mandate to try. So in an odd kind of way, it wasn't that surprising. I mean, what else was he supposed to do? I mean, it didn't come as such a surprise to me, because, and certainly knowing the Tories as I do now, I mean, these people were not going to kind of give up any chance of getting their clammy hands on power. That's what they live for. So, that was all they could do, in a sense.
And you had your negotiating teams, but was there any personal chats away from the teams between you and Cameron and
yes.
you and Brown?
Yeah, no, there were. So there was, well, in fact, it almost explicitly worked like that. So there was the Conservatives had, who did they have?
Haig,
Letwin, and was it Osborne, I think?
It was Osborne, yeah.
And it was David Laws and Danny and Chris Hughne and Andrew Stunnell. And then the Labour lot had their group.
Nice.
Yeah. None of the leaders were ever in those meetings. And then I would meet with Cameron, and I met with Brown. Yes, it was very surreal.
So with Cameron, the initial meeting, was there an instinct on your part, not only because of the democratic mandate that you'd suggested, the legitimacy argument, but that also in terms of character, he would be an easier person to form a government with than Gordon Brown would?
Yeah, I felt that quite quickly. I mean, you know, Cameron's, both his strength and his weakness, to be honest, is he's a very kind of, he's a wily, quicksilver politician, yeah. which has made him at least a politician who, well, until he, you know, screwed up on the Europe thing. he was forever getting out of scraps and tight corners. I would march into every elephant trap available, and he was much more wily than me at sort of avoiding them. You could feel that immediately, that he was, you know, he was in a sense, I always felt when, you know, when hardline right-wing conservatives would say he's not really a conservative, you know, he's not a proper Thatcherite conservative. Actually, Cameron was a classic conservative. Mm-hmm. Power first, being in charge first. For what reason? For what purpose? Entirely secondary. and he was like, you know, he was a slightly patrician, sort of home counties type Tory. Very, very much, you know, perhaps more of the sort of Macmillan ilk, really.
Yeah.
And you felt there wasn't very much ideological kind of baggage or, you know, sort of oomph there, but there was someone who was very pragmatic and very kind of quick. So you did feel that quite quickly. Gordon Brown, as you, I think, intimated earlier, I mean, he's an unusual character. He's very incredibly impressive.
Yeah.
He's got massive kind of, his kind of brain power is formidable. But partly because of that, he'd sort of talk to you in paragraphs. He's sort of, do you know those people who sort of, you sort of, I've got to wait for the paragraph to be completed and the filter before I can say something? It was like that. He'd sort of give you these granite-like paragraphs, and it'd be quite difficult to sort of steer.
And I did Ed Miliband followed at the.
And I remember once when I was sat with Gordon Brown, and he got his big felt-tip pen out, and he kept writing all these numbers on the back of an envelope, literally on the back of an envelope, saying, "Oh, we could have the Applied, or we could have the SNP, or we could have the UN, we could have a Rainbow Coalition." Mm-hmm. And I almost physically had to take his arm and sort of put the pen away and say, Gordon, it just doesn't, because there wasn't an arithmetical. There was no majority.
No.
You know, so it's just not going to work.
Did you feel slightly hard done by Labour people? Because there will always
be just a bit.
Because there will always be harsh contentions, and there will always be people trying to use party advantage, and that's fine. But the Labour Party did, to my mind, sort of spread the myth that actually it was equal numbers, and the Lib Dems chose deliberately to go into bed with the Tories rather than form a coalition with Labour because the numbers were fairly similar on both sides.
I mean,
we knew that not to be the case.
It's just flatly not true. And no, I mean, still to this day, you know, in sort of public meetings, people say, why did you choose the Conservatives over Labour? But that wasn't the choice. It was either a coalition or another election, basically, and the only coalition that could work. I think the Labour Party said that because it was an essential ingredient to the kind of betrayal narrative, which is, you know, widely beloved of the British left, and I think of sort of, you know, sort of leftish leftist politics in most places. That's, you know, that sort of power has been cheated somewhere along the line, that their kind of rightful sort of justification to do the right thing by the people has been, they've been diddled out of it.
By the media.
Where is that? It's the media. Well, of course, during the years of the coalition, it was me. You know, I was the sort of Judas Iscariot of British politics, and I'd kind of given up all my principles for power, and that was a necessary thing for the Labour Party, and it was very successful to them, and they harvested great Lib Dem votes for it. They got, you know, Polly Toynbee echoed this with knobs on every... Sorry, I'll rephrase that. echoed that sort of thesis, you know, in The Guardian every week. And, you know, it was very much a kind of... It was a very powerful emotional narrative, which was, you know, this is a sort of mongrel government, and it's malformed, and this, and the Lib Dems have sort of lost their soul. And if it wasn't like, if it was proper healthy politics, you know, we would be in charge, kind of thing. So I think it was necessary for them to intimate that somehow we did something dastardly around Labour, which, you know, really wasn't the case, because there was no majority to be had with Labour. And my own view is, whilst it was politically successful for Labour, and obviously did immense damage to us, and it was, as I say, it was amplified a lot by the sort of left-wing press. I think the great disservice it did to Labour itself, which I think is now coming home to roost, is it meant that Labour stopped thinking after 2010, because all they needed to do was just, you know, just work themselves up into a lather of indignation and betrayal, and they just stopped thinking about what they would do. What would they do about the deficit? What would they do about poverty? You know, it was just constant vilification, and I think it left them very kind of intellectually... The cupboard was bare by 2015 for them, I think.
There's also an element
more serious than
No, it's good, because I think there's also an element, and I totally agree, perhaps of revenge as well, is that many people in the Labour Party were sick of having the moral low ground and sick of being the victim of protest votes, and then they want to go. And there was that sort of, you know, those street wars between Labour and Lib Dem, people fought over years and years and years.
And to be fair, there was nothing more.
It's our turn now.
And there's nothing more sanctimonious than the Lib Dems on the campaign trail. No, we did sanctimony very well. I get that. No, listen, of course. And that's, listen, you live by the sword and you die by the sword. And lots of stuff was quite rightly thrown back in our face. And all of that, I get that. And I think that was right. I think they'd, you know, for so long on everything, like particularly on Iraq, and then on touchstone liberal issues like, you know, ID cards and, you know, 90 days detention without charge and all that kind of stuff, where Labour activists felt incredibly uncomfortable having these sort of pesky, sanctimonious local Liberal Democrat, you know, candidates reminding them. And then in a sense, what the Liberal Democrats were in the latter years of the Blair-Brown era, we were like a slightly holier-than-thou conscience, if you like, for the Labour Party. So when that conscience then goes to and governs with the, you know, the people who you think are truly beastly, then of course, I'm not pretending that I wouldn't do anything else if I was a Labour activist, but it certainly wasn't particularly nice to be subject to. But much more important than that, I think it led the Labour Party, it lulled themselves into sort of not thinking challengingly about what they had to, you know, what kind of policy ideas they had to develop themselves.
Obviously, the biggest rod to beat you with was tuition fees.
Just a bit.
I was just going to say, do people still ask you about this? And I was just about to ask you about it. But in the street, do people still mention it?
Now?
Yeah.
No, oddly enough, not really. I mean...
Too busy working a second job to pay the fucking debt. Yeah, yeah.
All right.
That was a low blow, but...
It was good, that was good. It was very good, very good, very good. No, they don't really. My own experience, but I'm sure you'll correct me, but is that the people for whom the kind of sense of betrayal about that was greatest over time wasn't actually the kids who went into the system.
Yeah.
It was particularly the parents who... Particularly, I found parents who... hadn't gone to university themselves, were incredibly proud that their kids were going to university, and then were saying, "Hang on a minute, you know, finally, my daughter's going to have, I'm going to have the photograph of my daughter with a graduation gown on my mantelpiece. It's the proudest moment for me as an aspirational parent, and now you've broken your word and you've saddled them with that." It's those parents who, in my experience, are the most, and I can totally understand why, the most unforgiving. So if there are, you know, if it does come up, it's often the parents, particularly, you know, with that kind of, with that experience, if I can put it that way.
you talk about it in your book, and what I find really interesting in it is that you say effectively that it should never have really been Lib Dem policy in the first place. Was that this was something that you were kind of against anyway, but you sort of drifted along with it, and then the famous photo that the NUS had sort of done. So in the you were fighting elections on slightly reluctant policies.
Yeah, yeah. No, the original sin of many original sins was, I mean, and by the way, and people. Of course, I totally understand this. History does tend to get slightly reinvented. So everyone now sort of thinks that 2010 was year zero and there was no tuition fees. That's not actually true, of course. Fees had been introduced many years earlier by Labour. And then, given how sanctimonious Labour was about what happened to us, they were increased again despite a manifesto commitment from Labour not to. What our huge mistake, and you're quite right, it was a mistake that myself and Danny Alexander and Vince Cable and David Laws in particular.
But mainly Vince Cable.
No. We all thought that it was just in an era of, you know, money was very tight and we'd had this terrible crash in 2008 and the state of the public finances was, and it's a hugely expensive thing to do. And remember also, I mean, there is a sort of slightly more subtle thing about all this, which is that it is a hugely expensive subsidy paid for by lots of people who haven't gone to university to pay lots of people to go to university. So, you know, if you're having to choose, would you really choose that? Anyway, the huge mistake was that no one in that sort of senior group in the Liberal Democrats felt it was a sensible thing to do, but of course it's a very popular thing to do, particularly amongst middle-class families and middle-class university-going communities and so on. And we tried constantly to try and change it, and there was a MP, Stephen Williams, who spent a long time trying to devise different ways of doing it, and then in government we tried to devise a graduate tax, which, by the way, essentially is what it is. Yeah. And if it was called a graduate tax, I suspect people would find it more digestible. But anyway, you're right. The original sin was we went into the election with a commitment that no one in the senior team thought was sensible. So much so that I refused as leader to have it on the front page of our manifesto. So it wasn't the front page of the manifesto. Yeah. I barely actually talked about it very much in the election, except for, as you say, that famous photo. And if anyone needs any evidence that it's photos that speak much more powerfully than words, it's what happened to me. So beware. Beware.
So when that, you had that student protest, because I went down just to watch it out of morbid interest.
Did you? Right, okay.
I wasn't on it. I'm not that sort of person, but I just thought, I want to sort of see this happen. And then it ends, it culminates from that guy dropping a fire extinguisher off the top of Millbank Tower and all that, and it went far too far. Were you sort of nervous at that point? Did you think they might come through the windows or something?
No, I didn't. Though I remember, of course, there were quite a lot of demonstrations. I can't remember which one it was, but I think it was the first big one. I was giving a speech up at the other end of Whitehall, and I was in the car being driven by the police, and they said to me, you've got to lie on the back of the seat, Deputy Prime Minister, which is quite a difficult thing for a policeman to say. Could you please just lie on the back seat with your red box on top of you so that the protesters were milling around in Whitehall. And then they had to get me back from then in Whitehall back into the Cabinet Office.
So you laid there?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what sort of, like, on your back or on your sides?
I'm going to show you how I lay on that.
But there must have been a point going through your head where you thought, what the fuck?
Yeah. What? Well, no. But then later, after I gave the speech, they had to sort of smuggle. There's a whole set. I mean, it's quite James Bond-esque, this. I didn't know they existed. There's a set of corridors underground.
So what are you doing next?
James Bond.
Yeah.
Well, there's an idea. But there's a whole set of passageways underneath Whitehall, and there was one connecting the Ministry of Defence to the Cabinet Office. So I was sort of smuggled through like a sort of dirty secret back into my office through this underground passageway. So yeah, no, of course I did realise then it was. But I mean, perhaps it shows my immense naivety. Even at that stage, I remember thinking, I've just got to explain it better. Mm. You know, I just have to explain, you don't have to pay it off if you can't, and you'll actually pay out less from your bank every month than you did under the old system. And no, it's not a debt, because if you'll only pay it back when you can afford to, and it'll, the people who earn the most. But, you know, I had this incredibly naive, and I remember I went on Jeremy Vine live when they were talking to demonstrators, and I started trying to argue with one of the demonstrators about the policy. And of course I could have told them the moon was made of cheese for all they cared. I mean, they just weren't by that stage, of course. You become such a cardboard cutout.
I think Douglas Carswell has, actually.
And it doesn't make the tides. No, but that's the other thing, which I'm sure other politicians have told you, is either politicians who've been sort of massively lauded or massively vilified, it is a bit like an out-of-body experience, because you sort of feel this caricature being made of you, and then when you see it being sketched out, you think, well, surely people are not going to believe I'm not, and you, oh my God, they think I'm like that.
Yeah.
And then you have to make this leap that you then, when you answer questions, you remember you have to answer questions like the caricature of you rather than who you think you are yourself. It's quite a complex thing.
And what do you think your caricature was?
Well, I don't think it was a very favourable one on that stage.
I always feel for politicians, because I think the vast majority, regardless of party, come into politics with the right intention, and I think they leave with them as well. And I don't subscribe to the view that all politicians are ruined by it. And they're still human beings, which is what really strikes me, having worked for them, is the immense physical and emotional toll it takes on them and their families.
Yeah.
And I just remember that image of you the day after the election, resigning and very tearful. I mean, that must have been a whirlwind for you to try and control yourself.
You're picking the nice bits then, aren't you, of my,
oh, but we'll
my blue
nice,
career. Yeah.
But it's the emotional bits, because I honestly think
of course it's a very emotional thing.
And I think that the public are with you on it. I think part of the reason why, and it's similar to Blair in a way, is that when people really invest in a person, not just a politician, the so-called betrayal then is so much more magnified, because people felt about you that you weren't a politician. They didn't expect whatever they believed the betrayal to be.
And then I just became another politician who didn't...
But then there's that period afterwards where people then start to feel fondly about you again, and they go, oh, actually, you know, in retrospect, I like Nick Clegg. Yeah. I like Tony Blair, whatever. But at that point after the election in 2015 where you were quite tearful, were you sort of... What's going through your head at that point? Do you think, I can't cry on TV?
Of course I'm thinking that. What do you think?
Well, because
I think... What do you think? I was going, oh, my God.
Because I think
there's a bit of pride left.
Well...
Not much. Not much by that stage.
No. But I wonder if sometimes, and I think it would be justified, to maybe show a bit of emotion to let the public know that you're feeling something.
Yeah, but then if you did that...
Maybe not to.
You know, the Daily Mail would just go to town the floor. I mean, it really is... It's just, you know, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. But what you just said about people changing their... I remember the following day, I was back at home, having been out on the campaign trail for quite some time. And I, for some reason, got it in my head that my security vetted BlackBerry, because in government, I don't know whether it's changed now, but when I was in government, you weren't allowed to have iPhones and
That's
things, because they could be easily hacked by whoever. So you were given these security vetted BlackBerries, which were rubbish. You couldn't take a photograph with them, you can get on the internet. And Cameron and I actually texted and emailed quite a lot on sort of government business, so it was quite important. But I got it in my head immediately after the election that someone was going to turn up from the Home Office and say, right, we'll have that back now. Thanks. So I remember saying to my oldest son, go on, let's go, and I'm going to go and buy a phone. Do you want to come? You know, he's a 14-year-old. Oh, yeah, I'm going to the phone shop. And I was thinking, oh, God, this is going to be... This is in Putney in southwest London, and it was a Friday morning then. Yeah, no, actually, it was the Saturday morning. And I'm thinking, it's going to be really embarrassing. I've just been completely knocked for six by the British people, and it's just going to be all a bit... Oh. And yet, person after person came up to me and said, oh, that was so unfair. So then one lady came out in tears and said, Mr. Clegg, it's just so unfair. So I said to her...
Nice to see the wife again.
That's right. I said, there, Miriam. No. I said, I sort of, obviously thinking she was a Lib Dem. I said, well, you know, there. No, thank you so much for supporting the Lib Dem. She said, no, I didn't. I voted Green. What's that about? How do you vote for another party and then sort of weep about the fate of another party?
Well, because people still care about people, don't they? There is that, and I hope we retain it. And it feels like we're living in quite febrile times, even more than when you were in government, and that's changed very quickly in the last year. Is that this feels like there's a lot of anger out there.
Yeah, there's a lot.
And this is something your book deals with, is sort of calming it down, reason.
I've got
thought.
A book out, by the way.
And it's brilliant. It
Thank
really
you.
Is. And I'm not just saying that as a condition of you doing the gig.
It was.
Yeah, it was.
It was a contractual.
Absolutely. But it's a really good read for, I think, for anyone interested in politics, which hopefully most people in the room
should be.
But it's just a really good, thoughtful book, because all political books have their own structures and things, and the standard autobiography is sort of childhood, adolescence, and all the rest of it. This is just a book of recollections of government, but there's a lot of analysis in there, which I really enjoy. That's digestible. It's not impervious, but it's really what I find so inspiring about it is this idea that actually
simple answers are never the best in effect, if that's an effective way to paraphrase.
Yeah, you know, no, we live in a, you know, because you're quite right, a lot of people are angry. And by the way, they're angry with reason, with good reason. You know, there are millions and millions of people in across the developed world.
A lot of people seem to be angry at reason.
Well, but the thing is, if you're someone who, you know, hasn't had a pay rise or much of a pay rise since 2008, when the sort of banks went bust.
You've had a pay cut.
your kid can't get on the first, you know, the feet on the first rung of the property ladder, and you feel that your job is more insecure over time, and you feel the politicians, the bankers have never paid the price for what happened. You're really, really pissed off. And then all these politicians come along and they promise the earth and they never deliver and all that kind of stuff. And that's just been brewing and brewing and brewing for 8 years now. That's a long time to feel that level of insecurity, you know, stagnant income and so on. And then, of course, someone comes along and says, all these complex things, it's not that complex. All you need to do is build a wall and keep the Mexicans out. Or it's all Brussels' fault. Or it's all Islam's fault. Or if you're a Scottish nationalist, it's all, you know, it's all London's fault. It's as old as the hills, populist politics. It takes fear and anger, and then it points a finger. And it points a finger at something or somebody, or a religion, or a group, or a community. That's what populists have always done. And that's what's happening now on a massive scale. And I think we're of a generation that didn't think that was possible. We sort of thought our democracies had become so mature and sophisticated that wouldn't happen again. But it is happening again. And yeah, so I don't think I've come up with a comprehensive answer. But one of the reasons I wrote the book was, you know, so on earth does the politics of reason and evidence and compromise, which is much more pastel coloured.
Yeah.
You know, it's much less vivid than the build the wall politics. How do you make a comeback? And one of the ways is kind of what you're touching on is that, and I'm sure I know I'm guilty of this, is that the moderate politics became bloodless and technocratic and lost emotion and lost feeling. And people actually vote with, you know, the vote because of feeling rather than thought. I mean, the heart is it's a much more powerful kind of muscle. It's not a muscle, is it? Anyway, it's a much more powerful organ in terms of why people vote than the brain. And I think liberals, small L liberals, forgot that. And I include myself in that.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Because this is a huge, particularly the fallout from the referendum, a huge opportunity for the Lib Dems. And Tim Farron has tried to make the Lib Dems the party of the 48%, sort of in a slight way that the SNP did with the 45% in Scotland. And obviously the context is very different with that. Do you think with Corbyn, the fallout from the referendum, that the Lib Dems can rapidly increase their share of seats at the next election if they position themselves in this way?
No, definitely. I've no doubt at all. I think the
polls doesn't seem to be there yet.
No, but I mean, polls. What?
You look like you changed your mind.
No. What I was going to say was, I actually think most people at the moment. I mean, and of course, most normal people are not like us. They're not interested in politics. They don't follow all the ins and outs of politics. Most people are really fed up with politics now. They've been asked to vote again and again and again. All this dramatic stuff is happening on Europe. They're just getting on with their. And it doesn't surprise me that if you ask them how they're going to vote in a general election, when they know there isn't a general election soon, you probably get quite a sort of static response. So I don't think the polls will budge necessarily overnight. But something's budging. I'll rephrase that again.
But, it's warm in here.
It's very cold out there. Something is changing. If you look at local by-elections, which happen every week, and they happen under the radar screen. They're not reported about, but they happen around the country.
Lib Dems are doing incredibly
well. I mean, we've won more local by-elections in the last several months than I think all the other parties kind of put together. We've put on more seats in the local elections in May. So that means where we are out, knocking on people's doors in Sheffield. I was out canvassing a few weeks ago. We won a by-election, went from fourth place to first place. These are all straws in the wind, but they suggest to me that things can change more quickly than might appear to be the case. And there's certainly a big gap there, right in the centre ground.
Certainly is. What do you make of Corbyn?
Well, I don't know him very well. I mean, I think I have to say to you, I do think his demeanour, just the way he appears, I can see why that's incredibly appealing. Because he's everything that kind of slick, perfectly polished politicians are not. He looks like a sort of slightly shambolic, quite sort of sweet uncle who's just come off his allotment and is showing you his sort of his beautiful new courgette or something.
Rephrase that.
Rephrase that, yeah. Something's budging. This is so smutty. I don't know. No, so I think I can see why his demeanour is really appealing for people who want something to be different and new and authentic, and he doesn't talk like other. I can see that. I don't mean this, it sounds a bit facetious, but I just don't understand the point, because politics for me, by definition, is the sort of marriage of high ideals and great values and dreams with, yes, something which is pretty rough and ready, and it's pretty tough, and it's very imperfect, and it never goes exactly as you want, and that's the merit, that's what politics is about. But it seems to me what he's about, and a lot of his supporters at least, isn't actually politics at all. It's what you do in academia, or in a think tank, or in a single issue campaign group, or a sect, or a religion. It's dreaming of a utopia, and actually not being particularly interested about doing it. Yeah. And in the same way that I very much agree with you, I've become a sort of, in my latter days, I've become a sort of one-man sort of trade union standing up for politicians, because I actually think politicians aren't all evil, venal, amoral beings. I also think, politics, yes, it is a rough old business. It's not, it does mean getting your hands dirty. And it seems to me that I don't think the sort of Corbyn ethos wants to get its hands dirty. It doesn't actually want to do
politics. Apart from the allotment.
And that's the bit which I just think is just wrong, because I can get that if Jeremy Corbyn was an incredibly popular, I don't know, if he was running Liberty or Greenpeace, I could get that. You're a great standard bearer for a purer, better world that we all dream of. But to be the leader of the principal party of opposition, whose job it is to keep the powerful to account, and he's just not doing that. I think that's wrong. I think it's really wrong. This government is getting away with blue murder.
I think a lot of people agree with that, and I think even a lot of people that initially supported Corbyn are starting to become dissatisfied with the sort of lack of progress and the frustration of week in, week out, seeing the Tories being failed to be held to account.
Yeah, and particularly on the Brexit stuff. I mean, it just beggars. I mean, today, did you see this? You see this? Boris Johnson was in Turkey. I mean, I just, it's unbelievable. This guy, the gall of it, there's a chutzpah of it. He told us all, do you remember, before the 23rd of June, that one of the big reasons, you'll do the impersonation.
These Turkish, they're coming, I'm part Turkish myself, but a lot of them want to come.
18 million,
40 million, 400 million Turks, a billion of them all scuttling over here. Back of a transit van or whatever it is.
Exactly. So he said that. And now do what he did today. I won't try and do it. But he went to Erdogan and said, and we'll do everything to get Turkey into the European Union. I mean, I find it amazing. And no one's challenging these people. And, Fox, Liam Fox. I mean, he's become a... Sort of I do think Liam Fox is a particularly sort of becoming a particularly sort of ludicrous figure in government. No, because he's going around. I mean, he hasn't realised yet. He hasn't got a job. I mean, he doesn't have a job. I mean, serious. It's not even. It's wonderful. It's funny. It's true. He doesn't have a job because. If they choose not to leave the customs union as part of Brexit, then he can't negotiate new agreements. But even if they do, they can't do that for several years. He literally has nothing to do. And then he goes around giving these incredibly inane speeches. So say it's all going to be fine, it's going to be brilliant, and we're a great trading nation, and da-da-da-da-da. And it's just based on no evidence. And no one is holding these people to account. And that's what the Labour Party should be doing. Of course, the Lib Dems should be doing it. We are. Tim Farrelly is doing a brilliant job. But, you know, we are only 8 MPs now. And unless anyone had not noticed that. And that's why I just think it's, you know, that's why I just think it, I mean, it's bad enough, of course, I would say this. I think it's bad enough that we're leaving the European Union on what I consider to be false pretenses. But now we're doing so with a bunch of people in government who don't know, you know, don't know where they're coming or going on it, and Corbyn's not addressing that. I mean, I think in his speech today he barely talked about it. It's the biggest thing to hit our country and future generations, and he won't even talk about it. I'll stop ranting.
No, because it's what I think is obvious is that the fire still burns. You know, a lot of people who've been in government and then find themselves out of it are sort of relieved that it's over. People like Jack Straw and Alistair Darling, you can sort of feel that the weight's been lifted. With you, however, there's still energy in the tank. I mean, you look younger than me, and you look younger than you did in government. I mean, is there a part?
Because I had a lot of acne when I was young. Did you see the report today?
No, I didn't. No.
Yeah. All of those of you who had, like I did, acne when you were young, it pays off. There was a scientific study saying people who had lots of spots when they were young look younger when they're older. So there you go.
Finally, yeah. After years of Googling, you found
yes.
The...
So now you know what I do all day. But useless facts.
Do you still think part of you could go back and lead the Lib Dems at some point?
No. You don't reheat sort of.
But
old
Salmon
coffee.
Did. Farage did.
No. I know I would say this anyway. Of course I would, even if I didn't think it. But I do think it. I really do think Tim Farron is doing it. It's an incredibly difficult job to pick a party up after the hammering we got last year. Mm. And I think he's doing it incredibly well. And I wouldn't. And he's asked. He's asked me to play a role. Asking government questions about the Brexit stuff, which I'm doing with pleasure.
So maybe not now, but if Tim was to go after the next election,
I can't envisage it at all. I really can't.
But I think there'd be an appetite for it. I think people think, well, out of the 8 Lib Dem MPs, a lot of people would say, well, you're that wasn't meant to be like that. But a lot of people would say, well, you're the
vast
best.
Electorate.
But a lot of people would look at this and say, well, you're clearly one of the best.
It's not going to happen.
Okay. Because
it's not going to happen.
Okay,
I don't want to.
Okay. Maybe. I mean, I'll tell you what was interesting, I thought, about your period in government, was that the intense psychodramas that you get in the Tory party and the Labour party, you'd always had a light shone on them for so long. And in the Lib Dems, actually, you'd sort of got away with all the sort of tensions below the water. Government brought that out a bit. And one of my favourite bits of TV, political TV, was when you and Chris Hoon were standing against each other. And I think it's on. Is it the Andrew
Marvel? Yes.
Oh, the Daily Politics. No,
it's Andrew Neil, yeah.
It's Andrew Neil. And he says, but you've been briefing against him. And you go, what? And Chris Hoon's going, I know nothing about this.
No, it's really cool.
Calamity Clay.
That's right.
Because we've got a briefing note here called Calamity Clay.
That's right.
Well, your office have been putting it out. And he's going, I don't know why it's Irish. But what's brilliant is, if you didn't know that briefing exists, and I kind of hope you did, you act as if though you hadn't. And it's such a great bit of method acting. You go, what? What's this? But just enough.
I genuinely didn't know there was a file called... Why do you think I should know there's a file called Calamity Clay?
Because whispers get out, don't they? You know?
But Chris was also magnificent. I mean, he's a very thick-skinned, sort of carnivorous politician. He sort of blustered his way through it perfectly. Didn't seem in the slightest bit embarrassed by it at all.
And did that affect your personal relationship?
A bit. You know, he did. I mean, Chris and I actually go back a long way because we were MEPs together. And in fact, I think he was about the only Lib Dem that came to...
prison.
You go to prison. You come to prison.
I know, but it was quick enough.
It was a very good one. I was about to say to our wedding, not Chris and my wedding, the Miriam and my wedding. Yes.
So he was actually, as far as politician friends go, one of the closest.
Yeah, yeah, no, he were, and of course it has an effect. And but you know, I still see him from time to time.
did you visit him in prison?
No.
Did you want to?
Actually, I think if I had not been Deputy Prime Minister, and I felt I could have done without a whole bank of cameras, you know, yes, I probably would have done.
And did you? I mean, it was so shocking when anyone goes to prison.
Yes.
But did you think, oh my God, I hope he's going to be? Did you sort of have these sort of Shawshank nightmares about him?
No, I didn't. I'll tell you what, though. Now,
the Shawshank Lib Dem.
One of the most surreal moments that I had ever in politics actually relates directly to the day when the Director of Public Prosecutions announced, so Keir
Starmer.
Yes, now a Labour MP. I'm sure that had nothing to do with his willingness to prosecute a Lib Dem cabinet minister. Sure, it genuinely didn't, by the way. But we were all, the then much larger Lib Dem parliamentary party, we were at a slightly sort of faded seaside hotel in Eastbourne. And I remember it was very cold outside. And there was just that... There's a theme developing. And there was an absolute bank of journalists outside because they knew that Chris Huhne's fate was going to be sort of sealed that day. What was Keir Starmer going to announce that he was going to be prosecuted or not? And everyone was down in a sort of conference room in this hotel in Eastbourne, all the MPs, and I was upstairs with Danny and a few other people. And then the news came through that Keir Starmer said he was going to be prosecuted. I spoke to Chris Huhne. He obviously had to resign. I then needed to decide who was going to replace him, Ed Davey. I spoke to Ed Davey, and I went down in a very somber mood, of course, and conscious of the fact that all, you know, the nation's media was outside and great furore about, you know, what was happening to Chris Huhne and all the rest of it. Came down to the conference centre to announce to the Lib Dem MPs there, and I found the Lib Dem MPs being addressed by a man in a bee suit who was called Barnaby the Eastbourne Buzz, who was being introduced by a wildly over-enthusiastic Lib Dem MP for Eastbourne. And they were all engrossed in what this bee was saying. Well, I was trying, it was just a mixture of the office and the thick of it. So I was trying to explain to them just what happened to one of their colleagues. Oh, that's fine, just turn back to the bee, you know.
So he goes to prison and all that, and it was a spectacular fall from grace, wasn't
it? Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Did the party sort of look after him?
I think so. I mean, Chris is one of the most resilient people I've ever met in political life. And I mean, the last time I saw him a few months ago, we had lunch together. I mean, he really is extraordinary. I mean, he's sort of picked himself up. He's got all sorts of entrepreneurial initiatives. He's
learned a lot of woodworking. He's
doing some great knitting. I mean, he's not. But what's very admirable about Chris, actually, he never expects anyone to feel sorry for him. You know, he sort of, boy, did he take it on the chin. And
So other Lib Dem colleagues then, so particularly ex-leaders, it's always interesting seeing leaders' relationship with ex-leaders. We've been very kind about Tim Farron. Paddy Ashdown sort of is more outspoken, isn't he? Yeah. More outspoken about Tim, more outspoken about politics. Did you find him a sort of help or a hindrance when you were leading the party?
A massive help. I mean, Paddy is the closest I have. He's not only a very close friend, he's the closest I have to a sort of, a mentor, really, I think. He's always been incredibly supportive. He's sort of just ferociously loyal. I mean, doesn't pull his punches when he thinks. I mean, I remember he once walked into my marched in. He doesn't walk; he marches. He marched into my office and sat down and said, "You're fat." Sort of sat up and no, he said, "Can't go in the election campaign. You're fat." And he sort of instructed me to sort of lose weight.
But you did.
I started doing Gordon Brown in prison.
You did put on weight in government.
Yes,
and quite quickly.
Yes, very quickly.
Why was that?
Well, because, I mean, it is impossible to describe. I mean, it was perhaps doubly or triply, quintuply the case for me, just because Whitehall wasn't prepared. Well, didn't really have the arrangements in place to support a deputy prime minister properly in a coalition. But it is, I mean, it is a massive, massive shock to the system. You know, you fought a campaign. You know, most normal people just want to go to sleep and hibernate after a campaign. And you get immediately thrown into those coalition negotiations, then immediately thrown into government, immediately thrown into Whitehall system, which is not used to coalition. And you just get this tsunami. I mean, there's piles and piles
of cakes.
Paperwork. What?
Of cakes.
Of cakes. Of donuts. of paperwork, which you have to sort of churn through every night before giving it back, all annotated and commented on the following morning. Ridiculous. I mean, pages on stuff on local government financing formulas and energy subsidy, you know, calculations and all sorts of stuff you've got the faintest idea about. And they give you all this stuff. And particularly at the beginning, when the whole machine is trying to kind of work out, you know, what the coalition government wants to do, the civil servants were just churning out stuff for Cameron and me to kind of then try and work out amongst ourselves what we wanted to do. And I'd go home and I would then, after the kids went to bed, I'd sort of sit there with this sort of paper all around me. I'd often sort of go to sleep sort of dribbling over some submission from the Treasury, wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and carry on trying to do that. And so you just, you know, I think if you work through the middle of the night like that, week after week after week, you tend to get very tired. And then I certainly find when I get tired, I eat too much. So maybe that's the reason why I put on too much weight.
And was there a staple of the Clegg diet at that point?
Just everything, really. Just large bowls of cereal on my own at night.
What sort of cereal? It's like Mum's Net, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm quite a Cheerios fan, I have to say.
Yeah. Really? We're big with the Cheerios? They're sort of in the
this
right...
This is irrelevant, kind of, actually.
The thing is with Cheerios, what's great about the Cheerios is... and I think a lot about this stuff is... Yeah. They're not sugary enough that you feel like an infant eating.
Exactly.
They sort
of if you eat Frosties or Sugar Puffs, and I tried Sugar Puffs the other day, again, for that very reason, it's just... After a while, it's just too sugary. It was Cheerios. It's a middle-aged cereal, I think.
Yeah, and they look quite healthy as well. There's not a cartoon wolf on the box.
And it's not shiny. They're not shiny.
No, you don't get free shit in them.
No.
So you can sort of say, well, it's...
But it has something which looks very similar, unnervingly similar, actually, to Barnaby, the Eastbourne Buzz on the front.
Oh, it does. So you go for the honey Cheerios.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I see.
No, I go for honey Cheerios.
Not the full-grain multigrain.
No, the honey Cheerios.
It's just a nice detail to this.
But I don't eat it anymore, that's the point.
Okay, so what do you have for breakfast?
For breakfast?
Yeah.
Banana, toast, and a boiled egg.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's like a boxer's diet.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good, yeah. And then do you sort of treat yourself at night? Or?
Night? a bit of Ryvita, I find, with...
Oh, my God, you've got full health.
Philadelphia on top, a bit of Philadelphia, and then maybe something on top of that, yeah. Philadelphia with jam's good.
Ooh.
Yeah?
Ooh, that's good. A few people experimenting tonight, I think.
If we keep this up, you won't ask me any more questions.
But what are your vices then? Because you smoked a bit. Do you still smoke?
No, I stopped.
When did you stop?
I properly stopped a few weeks ago. Yes.
And was that your main vice?
Probably. It's boring, isn't it? Yeah, probably. And I didn't even smoke that much, but I have to get. No, I've genuinely stopped. But I mean, this is it. but I did. I have to confess. I found at the end of the day, and when you, because that's the other thing I found in the sort of half a decade or whatever that I was in government and the rest of it is, you're constantly with people the whole time, right? And stuff is being thrown at you the whole time, right? So, just noise. And so I think it wasn't even so much the cigarettes, it was just the excuse to go out to the sort of backyard and not have any noise and just smoke. It was like a sort of time out, I think. I think that's what I associated smoking with by the end. I didn't smoke that much, but at night, just on my own, no noise, no phone. Sounds a bit sad, but it was very, very nice.
No, I understand.
Before retiring for a bowl of Cheerios.
Right, let's open it up to the audience. So if you put your hand in the air, Tim will come around with a roving mic. Let us know what your name is. And if you can ask for one-sentence questions and one-sentence answers, we'll try and get round as many people as possible. The chap just in the middle row there was the first one with his hand up. So we can get the... we can just pass the microphone along. Let us know your name and let us know your question.
Hi, it's Graham here. As a fan of cereals, if you pick the current top three leaders, in charge of our government, and have to pitch them celebrity deathmatch style against cereal mascots, who would you pitch against whom?
Fuck.
And why?
Can I get back to you afterwards?
No.
What's the question?
I'm not even sure I understand it.
Match three.
Do you remember Celebrity Deathmatch? That old animated...
Yeah, MTV. It was like plasticine fingers fighting each other.
I don't.
So,
not that old.
So what? You want Nick to...
I want Nick to pick serial characters versus our current government.
Okay, so for instance, Tony the Tiger...
I want Liam Fox against the... Honey Monster.
Exactly.
That's it.
Yeah. So, yeah. So
and the Honey Monster will win. The Honey Monster will win.
No, is exactly. But you've got to pick the top three against.
Oh. Okay. No. I'll come back to that.
Got fucking group stages for cereals. The chap in front had a question, but it was from while it lasted.
Hi, Nick. It's Alan. I want to take you back to the alternative vote referendum.
Yeah.
And pitch a hypothetical, which I suspect you won't want to answer, but I'm going to try and push.
Yeah,
you.
Sure.
If it passed, do you think you would still be in government with Labour or Tories, or do you think it would have made no difference?
Good question.
That's a good question. I think the cephologists say, I'm not actually, I think it would have helped us a bit last year. I think it would have possibly helped the Tories quite a bit, wouldn't it? I need to, because as you know, AV is not perfectly proportional. So I don't know what the outcome would have been. I don't know whether it would have delivered a majority or not. Well, do you know what the answer is?
No,
does anyone know?
No, that wasn't a trick question.
No, but does anyone know what the answer is? I don't know what the election was.
My hunch is that it would have helped you a little.
What?
It would have killed you.
Would have wiped out the Lib Dems.
Mr. Cheerful there.
Okay, let's... yes, the chap at the back with his hand in the air over there.
Hi, Nick. Leo here. With the rise of UKIP and the collapse of the Labour Party, are you concerned about the rhetoric that's coming from UKIP and the defection of voters from the Labour Party towards UKIP rather than to any other party?
Oh, yeah, I think UKIP's going to do exceptionally well in Northern England against Labour. And I think they probably would have done so under any leader. I've been for the last 11 years an MP in Sheffield, which is there's a little cake slice of Lib Demery in my constituency in South Wales.
What? They have the cake, mate. Yeah.
really yummy cake.
It's kind of like a little bowl of Cheerios.
The rest of it's a classic, northern metropolitan area. And I can see it in place after place after place that UKIP, particularly where they're well organised, can rise very, very fast. Because there are lots and lots of traditional Labour voters there who just don't feel connected with the Labour Party anymore. So I would anticipate, actually, almost regardless of what happens between now and the next general election, unless something very dramatic changes, that UKIP will do very well against Labour in the North. And look, in a kind of rationally representative parliament, which obviously we don't have, but if you had a properly proportional system, I think you'd have a healthy sort of chunk of MPs from the sort of far left. You'd have a healthy chunk of MPs from the far right, from UKIP. Then, of course, what would happen in the centre? Would it be, would the Tories splinter? Would you have a Christian Democratic Party, and then would you have a big liberal centre ground party? But it is deep, in my view, it is deeply, deeply unhealthy that we have a political system at the moment where millions and millions of people are voting for an option UKIP, which is not being expressed in Parliament. I mean, and I mean this in the purest sense, I think it is be so much healthier for us all if those 4 million votes for UKIP were properly expressed in a sizable UKIP parliamentary party.
Be a good laugh.
Well, it would certainly be that, but you know, because at the moment, as long as UKIP, on top of all its other grievances about the modern world, can claim that it's been shortchanged by the system, it just perpetuates this kind of sense of an outsider party being short, which it is being shortchanged by we are as well, but so are the Greens and so on. But at the moment we've got this really malformed party, ridiculous overrepresentation of the SNP. You know, they've got roughly 50% of the vote in Scotland, got more or less 100% of the seats. The Tories obviously wildly overrepresented. You believe it, Lib Dems, we've got 1 million more votes than the SNP. You know, they got 56 seats, we've got 8. I know it's very Lib Dem to say this, but it just seems to me that it's just got so out of whack with actually the choices people are making in the ballot box. That's really, really unhealthy.
Okay. Any questions from this side of the room? And it'd be good to have a few female questions if possible. There's a chap at the bar waving his arm. Let's go there.
Do apologise if this is a slightly personal question.
Oh, crikey.
Do you feel a need to justify yourself a lot of the time, in nights like this, for example? And if so, is that...
Well, it's a Q&A.
No, I meant the history of what happened. Is there a feeling to say, you know, this is why, this is what it was all about, because you feel you've been painted poorly, you know, by the brush of history?
Well, I think if I don't, no one else will. So, I'm sure there's a bit of that. I hope I do it in response to people's interest or questions rather than sort of plaintively or whingingly. No, I mean, look, I remain stubbornly and resolutely proud of what we did over 5 years. I didn't get everything right, of course not, but the big judgments, forming the government in the first place, sustaining it over 5 years, introducing some big reforms which I think will stand the test of time. I'm immensely proud of what we did. And so clearly, if I encounter people who don't think that, then I'll sort of...
Beat them up.
Give them a bowl of Cheerios, yeah.
And the final question to the lady on the balcony. The microphone's coming now.
Hi. You described Cameron as not necessarily having the passion of the Conservative Party behind him, with power-hungry kind of situation. How would you describe Theresa May's attitude in terms of Conservative values and that kind of drive?
To be fair to David Cameron, what I meant to say was that I think he was a very typical Conservative, actually, because he represented that quite long and very effective. I mean, one of the most effective parties in the democratic world. He represents, and I think almost distilled, actually, that slight sense of entitlement, that slight sense that, you know, chaps like him should always be in charge, and there's absolute nose for power. He was much less interested in political ideas or ideology, and that's quite a conservative, it's why it's such a pragmatic, ruthlessly flexible party. Theresa May, it's a real mystery to me. And it's a genuine, she sat next to me, to appropriately to my right-hand side, around the cabinet table. I would meet her once or twice a month, did that for half a decade. I really don't know. She was always very diligent, quite technocratic. Was, you know, do her homework, was thorough, and that was admirable. Tough, but I never really felt she was guided by a particular kind of vision. You know, I mean, vision of society or a particular kind of passion for this ethos or that value. She didn't breathe a word about education. Still less about selection of education, in 5 years. And suddenly we're told that's the great holy grail. So it's a really odd thing. We have a prime minister about whom I think we know less than any other prime minister in at least a generation
or two. And that's incredible. I mean, you stood next to her at the urinal for 5 years. I'm going to put you on the spot, Nick. Our next guest next month is Ed Balls.
Oh.
And one of the things I used to do, and I just stopped doing it, was getting... each guest to provide the first question for the next one. So what should my first question for Ed Balls next month be? I should have let you know this beforehand.
I can't. I'll give him a generic one. Would he prefer to travel back in time or travel forward to the future, and why? Is that right?
That's gone down really badly.
Oh dear.
What about a sort of personal question about him or his career?
Cereal mascot.
The fucking cereal mascot. I had no idea that cereals was going to be a real Pandora's box.
No, but I do hope you'll ask him whether he could come back. Because much though I disagree with him, I think he was a. I mean, he was a, you know, he was a serious heavyweight guy, and yeah. I think in all the senses of that word. I think he should. You know, people always lament that David Miliband hasn't come back.
Yeah.
I think it'd be good for the Labour Party if he comes back. So
a question for Red Bull from Nick Clegg is, will you come back?
Yeah.
I mean, it makes it sound like he's left you. Nick Clegg says, will you come back? He really misses you. Ladies and gentlemen, every night we've had down here has been very special. I'm sure you'll agree with me, this has been one of the best evenings we've ever had here, and one of the best guests, and just a superb evening, Nick. Next month, we've got Ed Balls. In November, it is Paddy Ashdown. Oh. January is Jess Phillips. February is Margaret Hodge. March is Nicky Morgan. Maybe not by the sounds of things. But a good political spread. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for coming. Thank you all for downloading the podcast and for making this evening special. But please, a massive thank you to the phenomenal Nick Clegg. There you go, Nick Clegg. So many brilliant stories in there. And again, I was thinking about this with Keir Starmer on the last episode. That felt like ages ago, 2019, 2016. My word. Obviously, we'd come through the Brexit referendum. But even that, 2016, I can't believe it's 7 years ago from 2023. I mean, maths tells me that it is. I'm not denying it as a fact. But Nick Clegg feels like he belongs to almost like the 70s. Politics just changed so much. And I don't mean that because of his attitudes or anything like that, but politics was so, sort of incremental for a while, and then so much has happened. The churn has been incredible. And actually, how rare to have someone as Deputy Prime Minister for 5 years. My word, well, there you go. I hope you're enjoying this selection of interviews from the back catalogue, and I shall bring you another one next week. As always, please leave a 5-star written review and tell your friends and family, and I'll see you next time. Ta-ra.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.